Welcome to Big Impact Astronomy, where we explore stories of how the stars are changing lives and connecting communities around the world. From stargazing under war-torn skies to bringing science education to isolated communities, we uncover the incredible impact of astronomy beyond the observatory. This episode of Big Impact Astronomy is brought to you by Prima Luce Labs. Prima Luce Labs makes space exploration accessible for all and empowers communities worldwide through innovative educational astronomy solutions. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mike Simmons, the founder of Astronomy for Equity. Today we have Jörg Matthias Datermann. And Matthias, which he goes by, is a faculty member in the Liberal Arts and Sciences program at Virginia Commonwealth University at the campus in Qatar in the Persian Gulf. And he's an associate editor of the Review of Middle East Studies and is the book review editor of the Journal of Arabian Studies. He's previously been at a number of different institutes, both in his native Germany and Austria, as well as in the UK, in Saudi Arabia, and other countries. He's been around quite a bit. He is the author of 6 books, and the one of particular interest to me here is this one, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in Astronomy, which I have the great honor to be in, having been interviewed by Matthias. His current book project is a history of teaching science with science fiction, which is a fascinating one, too, that we'll talk about. So I'm very pleased to have Matthias with us on the podcast. Welcome, Matthias. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor.
Let's talk about you a little bit. You have done this work in astronomy and other things, science with science fiction and so on. You have a really varied background that I find really interesting. Your name is German, Austrian, Germanic anyway, but you have been in many different countries and have a particular interest in Islamic culture and science and so on. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you come to have this wide variety of experience in some places.
Thank you so much, Mike. I'm a historian. I'm a historian of science who is especially interested in biology and astronomy and the combination of these fields in astrobiology, for instance, which is an area, astrobiology, that has a lot of connections with science fiction, with imaginations of alien life. I have often been interested in the other, in part because I myself was often the other. I was born in Germany, but I lived in other countries most of my life, in Austria, in the United Kingdom, in Saudi Arabia, and for over 10 years now in Qatar. And I've always been interested in other cultures. So I learned Arabic, I studied the Islamic religion, and most recently, I've also been very, very interested in the ultimate other for humanity, that is possible aliens, civilizations. And because I've been interested in the other, I've also been fascinated with questions of diversity, pluralism, how to deal ethically with the other, how to overcome barriers, how to overcome discrimination, and so on, leading me, among other things, to my work on diversity, equity, and inclusion in astronomy.
That's fascinating. Of course, it gets right to exactly what we're talking about with Astronomy for Equity, where the whole goal and a goal of this podcast to bring out the work that people are doing around the world in using astronomy for the benefit of the other, the benefit of everyone, inclusion, whether people are disabled in some way, excluded, marginalized in some way, culturally, geographically, politically, and all of these things. So that's great. So, and of course, the ultimate other is beings from elsewhere, which we have yet to find, but will happen, I think. What's your view on that?
That's a really good question. So, first of all, I'm quite convinced that there is life elsewhere in the universe, in part because it looks like the universe might be infinite, or it looks at least infinite pretty much in all directions that we can look. And if something is infinite, then we're probably able to find something within that infinity. So it is a very, very exciting time for astronomy and for all of humanity, of course, with new instruments coming online, like the James Webb Space Telescope, with us having discovered over 5,000 planets outside of our solar system, and with us finding out more and more about, in particular, the icy moons of our solar system, where we have water worlds, where we have oceans under the ice. And certainly if we look at liquid water on Earth, pretty much wherever we have liquid water, there's life, raising the prospects that maybe in these water worlds elsewhere in our solar system, there might be life as well. So yeah, like many, many people, I'm very enthusiastic about the astronomical research that's going on at the moment.
I agree. It's a very exciting time. Let's bring ourselves back down to Earth here. And I want to talk about, and we'll bring this up again, your book on diversity, equity, inclusion in astronomy, which I have here as well, A Modern History. It's absolutely fascinating book. It's really a concise history. And I have to say, I know so many of the people that you interviewed in this, as well as myself. I'm honored and delighted to be a part of this as well. My contributions seem minor by comparison with some of the true heroes that you talk about there. But it's a real history that where I learned quite a bit about some of the people that I've known for a long time and their backgrounds that I hadn't even realized. So what drew you to this topic in the first place? I know you're interested in that, but this, I mean, it seems so obvious in retrospect that this is something that's really needed. And I hope we'll get around quite a bit. Everybody in astronomy should read this. But what got you into this in the first place?
So I've been fascinated by questions of diversity, like by living in different countries, countries that are all diverse in their own ways. So I've lived, I had the privilege of living in cities like Munich, like Vienna, like London, like Riyadh, capital of Saudi Arabia, and now Doha, the capital of Qatar, that are all incredibly diverse. Qatar, for instance, has 90% of the population being foreign. So there are only 10% of the population in Qatar being Qataris, and 90% are foreigners all from all over the world, sort of reflecting a great plurality. Diversity is also something that I encountered by working at an American university, Virginia Commonwealth University. And in higher education, especially higher education, diversity, equity, and inclusion have become very important concepts, ideas, also buzzwords at times. And yet, what people understand by diversity, how diversity could look like, how it could be managed, might be very different from context to context, from institution to institution. What I've also been very, very interested in is the history of the movement behind those words. Sometimes when people think about diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher education, they might think about a DEI office at a university. They might think about bureaucracy and papers and maybe annual reports that show picture of people with different skin colors and genders and identities. But what I was interested in, like finding out, how did this movement start? How did we get here? We've perhaps always had astronomers from very, very different identities. Astronomy is, of course, one of the oldest sciences. People from every culture have always looked up at the stars. People from every gender, from every identity group that you can imagine have always wondered about the universe. And yet, at some point in the 20th century, all these people coalesced into a movement that pushed and put forward these ideas of justice, of inclusion, of equity, of diversity, of access. People who've been trying to move academic astronomy out of the ivory tower, people who have tried to make astronomy, academic, professional astronomy, less of an elite discipline, but less of an exclusive endeavor and more of an inclusive endeavor that brings people not just from the elites, but also from various marginalized identity groups of all kinds into this exciting field.
I so agree with you, Matthias. This is really important. And it's interesting that astronomy, I always say, is the most accessible, the most universal of all the sciences. And still, we have this idea of it being an elite science in some places, or somehow women may be discouraged as in sciences in general. So it seems really ironic that we would have any of these issues in astronomy. Now, you touched on one thing that really hits home for me. Having lived in all these different cities with the great diversity, you know, when I started traveling internationally, at first I was really kind of amazed when I found things that were the same in another culture as what I was used to. After a while, I realized they're just kind of different flavors of the same things. And now I'm really astonished when I find anything that seems like a really true difference between us. It seems to me that we're just different varieties of the same needs, the same ideas, the same cultures, like having different food, but we all have food. Is that something you find yourself? You have so much experience in different cultures.
Absolutely. And I think astronomy is a beautiful discipline that can emphasize our common humanity. So astronomy teaches us that we're all living under the same sky, that we're all looking up to the same stars and the same planets, that Venus might have different names in different languages and cultures, but it is of great importance to people around the world. Similar, Mars, the sun, the moon. Astronomy can teach us that we are ultimately all together on this journey through space, that Earth is like our spaceship, and that whatever problems and divisions we have between us humans, problems and barriers and political conflicts between countries and nations and different groups, all of these barriers can seem just very, very small problems compared to the infinite size of the universe.
Very well put, and I couldn't agree more. Of course, Carl Sagan and his famous pale blue dot say this extremely well. Legendary words. And also, talking to astronauts, I've learned that it isn't that they look down and don't see borders. In fact, there are some borders you can see, like India, Pakistan is all lit up. You can see it very clearly. It's that you see the Earth in space as that pale blue dot, though they see it up closer unless they've gone to the moon. Surrounded by stars, right down to the edge of the atmosphere, which is paper thin when you look at it from outside. So what strikes them is exactly what you just described, is that we are all on this one little planet amongst all the other planets. And we're just quibbling between, it's just a family issues that we're having, but we're all part of that same family. So I want to talk a little bit more in particular. I'm going to bring this book up again because I want everybody in astronomy to get this. I think this is really important. And I'm not even going to wait till the end. Matthias, tell us how people can get this book.
So the book is published by Springer, which is a major academic publisher that distributes its books globally. You can get it directly from the Springer website in a variety of formats. You can also get it from the major online retailers of books and from your local bookstore as well. The hardcover edition is quite expensive, so I fully understand if you might not be able to afford that one, in which case I would suggest you recommend it to your local public library for purchase so that maybe a copy becomes available for free to your community. And hopefully a more affordable paperback edition will be out maybe in a year's time or so, hopefully making the work as accessible as possible.
Is there any chance of an electronic version coming up?
Yeah, the book is available electronically. So you can either purchase an electronic copy yourself, or you can, again, also suggest one to your local library. So Springer, I think, probably distributes most of its research publications electronically.
So, and we'll bring that up again. Maybe we'll add a link to the page where the podcast is published, so people will be able to get it there. I know that it's Springer. It's an academic publication. These are the books that you see at academic conferences and things like this. Not bestsellers on Amazon, but I think this one is just really important. Not just for learning about the past, but how we got here and for the future. So diversity, equity, and inclusion in astronomy. Now, we use astronomy for so many different things. And as I said, astronomy for equity, that's the basis of it, where we are trying to highlight on this podcast all the people that use astronomy for really good things that people don't know about, and encourage and support programs that use astronomy to bring science and STEM in general to marginalized communities. And that's very important. But the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion, this comes about because of the harm that is done by issues with this. So I wonder if you can give some examples of how otherwise really good programs might be hurt by this. We know how it affects research in general, how if we're excluding women or people of color, we just have few people who can contribute to the field. But what about in other ways that impact the programs that would be doing good outside of the academic community, for example? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Astronomy is really a wonderful field that contributes so much to humanity and that excites so many people, young and old, people from around the world. However, it is also a field that at times has been marked by elitism. So astronomy in modern times is very close to physics, and physics, especially in the 20th century, for instance, became associated with secrecy at times, militarism, with programs to develop weapons, nuclear weapons, or other kinds of military systems, including radar, out of which radio astronomy came. Physics itself is often seen as a very elite science, a very exclusive science, and at that top levels, not very inclusive. So if you think about Nobel Prize winners in physics, you have a few women, obviously, on that list of Nobel Prize winners in physics, most famously Marie Curie. You have people from outside the West, of course, as physics Nobel laureates, but that list is still very dominated by white men. So astronomy, being not so distant from physics, is shaped by this, to a certain extent, exclusivism, elite science status. Now, why is elitism, why is exclusivity harmful? Well, astronomy is a science that relies to such a great extent on collaboration, maybe more so than many other sciences. We can't study all the stars from just one point on Earth continuously, right? We have a northern sky, we have a southern sky. If we want to understand both halves of the sky, we need to have observatories in the north collaborating with observatories in the south. The Earth, of course, is turning, and days and nights follow one another. When it becomes day in one place, the astronomers there, unless they're solar or lunar astronomers, they would have to stop observing the stars as it becomes bright. But that means somebody else has to pick up and follow those stars in order to study them continuously, in order to, for instance, look for small dips in brightness that might reveal transits of exoplanets in front of those stars. Big astronomical missions can't just rely on one country, on one nation. They can't rely on, let's say, military secrecy either. If you think about the James Webb Space Telescope that has collaborators not just from NASA, from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, but also from the European Space Agency, from the Canadian and Japanese space agencies. So these big, very, very expensive telescopes rely on collaboration across borders. I also said that the universe is perhaps infinitely big. And if you want to study something that is infinitely big with infinitely many objects, you have to get all the minds at work that you can get. If you exclude certain groups, certain minds, that means you don't have enough minds to study all the fascinating objects that are above us, all the black holes and active galactic nuclei and the thousands of exoplanets that we've discovered so far, and maybe the billions and billions of more exoplanets that might be out there. We just have to get as many people involved wherever they are in the world and whatever identities they might have in order to have enough resources to deal with the enormity of the cosmos.
That's wonderful. Great comments. Very well laid out in the book, which I'm now going to require everyone to read for homework. I think everybody involved in our organization should read it. Now, I want to come out of the ivory tower in academia to the broader landscape of astronomy. So while I did study astronomy in college as an undergraduate, I went into other areas of research, but I've been involved in public outreach for more than 50 years. And so this is really my arena. And that's where I find people interested in and doing astronomy everywhere. It's not an exception. I mean, I have introduced people in a country who said they're the only amateur astronomers in the country to other people that I knew because, you know, I act as sort of a hub for these having connections in different places. They really are everywhere. The interest is everywhere. And I've also been to places where they're doing outreach in astronomy. They don't have a telescope. That's one of the things we try to help with. So this fascination and this idea of sharing is huge. And now when I first got involved in astronomy, it really was academic. It was about science. And people who were interested on their own were completely separate. One of the changes that I've seen in astronomy over the years, and this started in Europe as far as what I saw, was scientists, people with PhDs, graduate students or younger, who were studying the science of astronomy, but who were interested in doing outreach and sharing with the public, and many of whom have gone after their PhD, ended up going into science communication, public outreach programs, formal education, many things like that. And this has been a really big change. And now the academic community works with the amateur astronomers around the world as well, which is necessary in some ways with citizen science. So public outreach is completely diverse, but it's kind of scattered. And this is one of the things I do to try and bring it all together. You don't really make a distinction in the book between these two areas, that this is really something that we're all interested in. We all have a different area. What are your thoughts in terms of DEI in education, in outreach, in astronomy as a hobby, and so on? Do you have some thoughts on that?
I mentioned earlier that parts of professional astronomy are very close to physics and thereby also very close to these elite spheres of physics that were at times marked by military secrecy, Cold War competition. And that proximity at times benefited astrophysicists, right? So if you're working on military-related projects, that means you have money coming in without needing to do outreach. So that was the situation at times during the Cold War, where there was just so much money being spent on defense research, on physics research, that astronomers, astrophysicists could benefit from some of the largesse of the Pentagon for their own research. That situation of the Cold War ended during the 1990s, when suddenly billions of dollars were no longer given away freely for physics. And physicists and astronomers had to convince a larger public that their science should be supported, not just for defense purposes. So ever since the 1990s, when, for instance, physicists were surprised by the cancellation of the superconducting supercollider in the United States, when physicists were shocked that big instrument projects could be cut, where physicists realized that maybe government support was no longer as readily available as during the Cold War, could no longer be taken for granted. Then many, many physicists, astrophysicists started putting more effort into public outreach, into public education, in order to convince taxpayers that spending money on science is worthwhile. Now, in parallel to these elite professional scientists that were close to the military-industrial complex, there always existed amateur astronomers going back perhaps to the beginnings of astronomy itself, right? Astronomy has this incredibly large and proud and venerable amateur tradition. And amateurs are really crucial for reaching the public, because they themselves are part of the public. Amateur astronomers are also more free to reach across borders. For instance, if you have an astrophysicist employed by a federal agency in the United States, or employed by a government organization in general, with that government employment comes certain constraints. And these constraints might be about, for instance, who to interact with, who not to interact with. So to give you an example, in the current political climate, for instance, that is marked by tensions between, let's say, the United States, China, Russia, government-employed scientists in any of these countries might find it hard to reach out to their counterparts. So let's say a federally employed professional NASA scientist might find it hard to travel to China and to share knowledge with his Chinese counterparts. Similarly, let's say a government-employed Russian scientist might find it hard to travel to the United States. Amateur astronomers don't have those constraints. Amateur astronomers can just travel as tourists to whatever country gives them an entry visa. And amateur astronomers can build these grassroots contacts. So I, for instance, hugely admired your own outreach to astronomers in Iran and in Iraq across political divides. And you could meet people and interact with people and collaborate with people that maybe many professional astronomers in the United States didn't feel that they could do, like especially in a world marked by a lot of divisions, political and otherwise. Amateur astronomers are in a unique position to reach across those divides.
Thank you for bringing up my own experiences too, which I think are good examples of what you're talking about. My international work began in the 1990s, 99 actually, after traveling to Iran for a total solar eclipse and connecting Americans and Iranians and writing about it and so on. But I know there are two examples I can give you. One who is a high-level employee of a NASA-supported agency who was Iranian and wanted to go home, and he wasn't able to. Now, Iranians ordinarily travel back and forth quite freely, but he wasn't able to. I know somebody else who was a former Department of Defense employee and no longer connected with him, and he wasn't able to go either for other purposes. So you're right that we can make those connections, which is the basis for, of course, what Astronomy for Equity is doing now. So not having those restrictions is a really big help. I've run into a lot of them. And I managed to sneak under the radar in a few places as well that I won't really go into now. What do you see for the future? Now, first of all, two things. One, you're working in another project that I want to talk about too. But what about the future of DEI in astronomy? Things have improved, but there's always pushback as well, which makes things very much more difficult. And we're seeing that especially in the United States in some areas. From your extensive work talking with people working in this area, what does the future hold? Are we doing more of the same? Do you think there are some actions or something that we're going to see that would be groundbreaking, or it's just pushing one step at a time?
So in the 20th and 21st century, astronomers and activists have led a revolution, a scientific revolution, a revolution not so dissimilar from other kinds of revolutions in science, like the Copernican Revolution, the revolution named after Nicolaus Copernicus, the revolution that put the sun rather than the earth at the center of our cosmos. Now, with the DEI revolution, the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Revolution, words like diversity, like inclusion, like access, and open access have become at the center of the scientific discipline. And now, as a result of this revolution, we nowadays, for instance, largely take for granted that open access is a good thing. We nowadays have so many women in leadership roles, many more women in leadership roles in astronomy than perhaps at any time before in history. So the demographic makeup, the social makeup of the astronomical profession has transformed. Maybe we're still lagging behind somewhat in terms of Nobel Prize winners' demographics. So I mentioned earlier that Nobel Prize winners in physics overall were and are still largely white men, but I have no doubt that that demographic will change as well. This revolution has achieved a lot, but it is still unfinished. It is still ongoing. And of course, revolutionaries also encounter resistance. Otherwise, you would not need revolutionaries. There's always pushback. If revolutionaries, if activists are trying to break down barriers and overcome barriers, usually these barriers are still upheld by some. most recently, for instance, in the United States, DEI efforts have become under attack of conservatives. There has been pushback. Programs have been defunded or rolled back or become more controversial. What will the future hold? But there are some dangers. There are some dangers that DEI efforts will not be able to overcome some of the divisions that we have in larger society, that, for instance, like people from one group are threatened by DEI efforts from another group. So you might have men being threatened by feminists, or you might have, for instance, people from majority society feeling threatened by activists campaigning for minority rights groups. So you have at times feeling of threat, feeling or feelings of fragility, divisions. My hope for the future is that there will be more solidarity, that DEI activists, just like they've done in the past as well, are uniting across the different identity groups that they represent. My hope is that, just like in the past, people who advance women see themselves as allies of people who advance the rights of disabled people, that disability activists see themselves as allies of people who are trying to advance indigenous rights, that indigenous activists are seeing themselves as allies to other groups that are fighting for marginalized identities, marginalized group. And I also hope that those who are currently in the majority, those who are currently in power, see that if we have inclusion, if we have access for everybody, that this would indeed benefit everybody, that diversity, equity, inclusion is not about a zero-sum game, that having more women does not necessarily mean having fewer men, but having more Black people in, let's say, leadership role doesn't necessarily mean fewer people of other ethnic and racial groups. But I hope that people will see that diversity, equity, and inclusion can uplift everybody, right? There is no limited number of spots for those who can study the universe, right? The universe is perhaps infinite. There is literally space for everyone. Yeah, I hope those who might currently feel threatened by DEI efforts see that, oh, like an activist who's campaigning for justice, equity, and inclusion is not trying to take anybody's place necessarily, but instead is just adding to the number of creative minds that currently work on the universe. And of course, the universe is so full of mystery, so full of incredible problems that really stretch the human imagination. If we really want to understand the nature of, let's say, black holes, we need every human mind that we can get, young and old, people of all skin colors, gender identities, abilities, and disability. And so my hope for the future is that DEI efforts can be marked by unity rather than by division.
We don't know where the next Stephen Hawking will come from. It may well be a woman in Uganda who was born 20 years ago. And we need to give everybody a chance, because so few have these remarkable breakthroughs and insights that we need to sample from everywhere.
And the beautiful thing about a lot of astronomy nowadays is you don't necessarily need to have an expensive telescope in Uganda, for instance, to do astronomical research. The robotic spacecraft and remotely controlled telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope produce enormous amounts of data, almost like infinite amounts of data. And this data is increasingly accessible by people everywhere as long as they have a computer and an internet connection. So if you are that gifted woman in Uganda and you have an internet connection and you have a computer and you have the right education and you've benefited from outreach programs, you can put your mind and your computer and that internet connection to use at almost any problem and any calculation that the data by the James Webb Telescope, Space Telescope allows.
And you mentioned remotely controlled telescopes. There are some made available for education as well, not nearly enough, but we are a global sky partner of Las Cumbres Observatory and had a short program last summer where we had STEM students, not necessarily astronomy students, because they had few laboratories and have great interest in it, in a university in Benghazi, Libya, who took part and learned how to construct a light curve for the supernova in M101, which is an experience they wouldn't have otherwise. So there are a lot of ways to do this. We're working on as much as we can of that sort of thing, because I find brilliant people everywhere. I call them diamonds in the rough. They haven't been polished yet, or nobody has seen them yet, but they are there and available to do so much work. You mentioned something else that struck me about this as being a revolution. And your description of the revolution reminded me of a book that was written 62 years ago, but I know you're very familiar with, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, a critical book that I only learned about recently and read for the first time. It's timeless, but it is like any sort of revolution as well. And you also mentioned something else that really strikes me, which is the siloing of people looking at their individual causes. We need more collaboration, and it's understandable to focus on what you're doing, but working together is really the key to having more impact. And that's honestly, I didn't even think of this till this moment, but this podcast, this is what it's about. We have so many people, hundreds of people, thousands around the world doing great work using astronomy, and people don't know about them. So the idea here is to give everybody a voice. There is also a matter of diversity in branching out into other areas such as art and science. And one of those is your new project, which is teaching science through science fiction. This is fantastic as a science fiction fan since I was very young. Science fiction is something where we can let our imaginations go and explore all kinds of things that we may not be able to do yet in the real world, including diversity, equity, and inclusion, such as the original series of Star Trek that brought a Russian in during the Cold War onto the bridge and a Black woman. Groundbreaking thing. So tell us a little bit about what your idea is with this new project.
You're absolutely right that science fiction itself is also revolutionary. You mentioned Star Trek, where, for instance, the first interracial kiss on mainstream American television happened. And the future portrayed by Star Trek was often utopian and ahead of its time, right? Star Trek had, the first female officer on like a major starship at a time when women were still largely excluded from most militaries around the world. Star Trek also had, for instance, a Black captain, captain, commander first, and then Captain Sisko in Star Trek Voyager, then had a female captain, Catherine Janeway. And Captain Sisko was in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, of course, as all the Trekkies here know. So Star Trek is one of many science fiction creations that is incredibly revolutionary and that is appealing to broader audiences, including people from all kinds of marginalized groups. I've been interested in the history of teaching science with science fiction most recently. And I'm again interested in exploring the tensions between, for instance, astronomy and astrophysics on the one hand as an elite science, as an exclusive science, and on the other hand, its potential to be much broader and having much more public appeal. Science fiction really inspires people from almost any group. People from all kinds of identity groups love stories about the universe, love stories about the stars, love stories about nature. And yet science fiction and fantasy have not always been considered serious literature. They've not always been considered respectable. They have been often denounced as too popular in many ways. And yet, innovative educators from around the world found science fiction a very, very useful teaching tool, a very useful tool for inspiring people who would not otherwise go into a professional science. So one of the founders of the modern field of science fiction, Hugo Gernsback, for instance, saw his magazine Wonder Stories as educational and advertised it as educational. One of the titles of that magazine was Science Wonder Stories. And interestingly, because it had this educational appeal, people like Isaac Asimov were allowed by their parents to read these science fiction magazines when they were young. Science fiction still at times had to struggle for respectability. So the modern science fiction as a mass phenomenon started with the pulp magazines. And of course, pulp magazines, pulp fiction was often looked down upon by the elite circles of science. And yet, time and again, we find scientists who were attracted to science fiction, who were themselves inspired by science fiction and used it as a teaching tool. So I'm interested in educators, writers who have tried to bridge the two cultures, the culture of art and the culture of science. I'm interested in figures such as Lawrence Krauss, for instance, who wrote a very, very popular book in the 1990s called The Physics of Star Trek, a book that gave rise to a whole cottage industry of books with the science of in the title. So the science of the X-Files, the science of Star Wars, the science of Harry Potter, the science of superheroes. And true, when you're still probably enrolling in an astronomy program or in an astrophysics program, maybe you still don't have necessarily the book, The Physics of Star Trek by Lawrence Krauss as a textbook. So yes, science fiction is still somewhat kept out of elite science and elite science education. But time and again, people have tried to bridge the area of the sci-fi conventions and the area of the halls of academic science of elite universities. I'm still at the beginning of this project. So if you are an astronomer who has taught astronomy using science fiction, I would love to hear from you wherever you are in the world. I've certainly come across, for instance, many people in the Arab world who have proposed to teach science through science fiction. And I believe that probably these people who are trying to bridge science and art, these two cultures, bring science and science fiction together, exist in every country. So please share your experiences with me.
Oh, that's great. And we'll do our best to let people know about that too. I'm looking forward to that. This has been a very rich conversation, and we may have to have you back to talk about that as well. Your new book. And once again, first, I want to thank you very much. Let me once again tout your book on diversity, equity, and inclusion in astronomy, modern history. So I want to thank you so much, Matthias, for joining us here for this. There's so much to think about in all of this, and best of luck with your new project, which I anxiously am looking forward to, and for the future.
Thank you so much. Big thanks to you and to Cassandra as well in the background, and all the best for your organization and for all your incredible initiatives. You are one of the true heroes of my book, and one of the true heroes, I feel, of DEI efforts in astronomy globally. Thank you for all you do.
This has been another episode of Big Impact Astronomy. I'm your host, Mike Simmons. Jacob Sager is our technical producer. Our audio engineer is Ali Pelfrey. Big Impact Astronomy is produced by Astronomy for Equity, bringing astronomy to unserved communities worldwide. This episode of Big Impact Astronomy was brought to you by Prima Luce Labs. Prima Luce Labs makes space exploration accessible for all and empowers communities worldwide through innovative educational astronomy solutions. Learn more about Astronomy for Equity, including how you can support us at astro4equity.org.